From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect, and I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll speak with Kevin Merida, a former Milwaukee Journal reporter who's gone on to big things at the Washington Post in an uncertain climate for print journalism. Then a huge grant to study the science of virtue could be a game changer in the world of education.
We are in very early stages of finding out what character is and of subsidizing character education. And everything that we can do to get clearer on that helps to address a rather urgent question, and that is, how can we raise good people?
We'll hear about the thrills of being a pro wrestling villain.
When I have a 85-year-old lady with thick glasses flipping me off and telling me how much she hates me, and you know that that's what I like the best.
And a recent book of essays taps writer Scott Jacobs' memories of childhood skiing in Wisconsin. Lake Effect comes your way next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in this morning. While he didn't grow up here, journalist Kevin Merida cut his teeth as a journalist as a beat reporter at the Milwaukee Journal in the late 70s and early 80s. After a stint at the Dallas Morning News, Merida joined the Washington Post, where he stayed for more than two decades. His work has ranged from covering presidential campaigns and Congress to a landmark series for the paper called Being a Black Man. He's also co-authored books on Clarence Thomas and Barack Obama. Merida is now managing editor for news and feature coverage at The Post, and he was the keynote speaker at an event in March that was co-sponsored by Marquette University and the Public Policy Forum. Merida joined Lake Effect's Mitch Teich in the studio then and compared the start of his career in Milwaukee with his work today at The Post.
Well, it was a great training ground for me. I a lot of tremendous reporters. That's my first job coming out of college. I love being in Milwaukee. That was a time when it was a great blue collar ethic here. It was an afternoon paper, so it was something different. The kind of work that I was interested in was really investigative work and also community work. And so, you know, I remember doing piece about a playground. I remember doing a drug investigation about a big drug ring that was kind of operating out of the underground. You know, I remember looking into dog fighting and spending a lot of time and nights trying to track down that organized dog fighting in Milwaukee. So, you know, I did a range of different work, general assignment work, and it really gave me a good foundation.
Are general assignment reporters today in a place like the Washington Post, are they doing the same kinds of things that a general – I mean, the news staffs in general were much larger places in those days. Is there more specialization or less specialization than there was in those days?
Well, I think there's more specialization, but we're in a different age. One of the things I do worry about is – just the notion of going out on the streets in the neighborhoods and in communities and just talking to people. You know, we used to always say in journalism school, there's no news in a newsroom. And because of the technological advance and there's so much you can do, people conduct interviews by email, there's so much data and charts, you can do some really compelling work and never have to leave your office. And it's work that we need to be done, but I sometimes worry that we're not on the ground enough and we're not picking up things organically with face-to-face human contact, and that's important to do that. And we still have some reporters that cruise. I like to see reporters cruising and just stopping in places where without a scheduled appointment, you know, just to find out what's going on, like Marvin Gaye used to say.
And competition has to be a different animal as well. I mean, when you were reporting for here in Milwaukee, this was a two daily newspaper town, and today, you know, Washington is a two paper town. But you're in competition with other newspapers. You're in competition with Facebook. You're in competition with everything. How does competition allow? How does the nature of competition allow you to keep your eyes on the prize, if you will?
Well, that's exactly right, Mitch. I mean, everyone's our competitor. Google's our competitor. Twitter's our competitor. Everybody who's sharing work is our competitor because you want to create work that's shared. But I do think that one of the things that we notice is that the more competitors, and particularly with the specialized natures, we are able to separate ourselves on the really big, important, large stories. I mean, you know, the Snowden documents that we had a share of those along with The Guardian, it opened up a whole discussion back in the country and in the world about the nature of surveillance and privacy and civil liberties. I don't know that a lot of news organizations would have been able to know what to do with that material and would have handled it and would have had the experts to sift through it the way we did. The healthcare law, which is important, affects, you know, millions and millions of Americans, affects everyone. We've been all over that. You know, we've been on the how it's being rolled out. There's an accountability role in which we make sure that the government is doing what it says it will do. And when things like Newtown happen, I must say people flock to us because they want to have information that's reliable, Navy Yard shooting. And they want journalism they can trust. And I think that's one of the things that, that we continue to bring and separate ourselves is our authority, the confidence that that readers can have in us, and knowing that we're going to we're going to be fast. We're going to try to be current. We're going to try to continue to innovate, but we're also going to be have those values of authority and reliability and expertise.
When your audience is really worldwide, do you have to change what you think of as the concept of local news? I mean, is the idea of local news almost an outdated concept?
Well, I think for the people in communities, they still want to know about each other. And so I think as long as we're anchored in Washington, D.C., and we are responsible for I think people see us responsible for the region. I think we'll always have local news. You know, when there's a shooting at the Columbia Mall, that's local. You know, and sure, there were other people who picked that up, but it's a very much a local story. Also, it's the Nationals are a local story. The Redskins are a local story. And there's been a lot of corruption in city government. Well, that's a local story. And that kind of reporting, that attention to that is going to be always a focus of ours along with all of the other kind of national and international reporting we do.
Well, let me take an example. As we have this conversation, we can go to the Washington Post's website, and there right at the front page is a video featuring an interview with a Democrat running for Senate in Maine. Do you see – is the audience for a feature like that and other kinds of coverage like that – Is that an audience that's around the world? Do you hope that someone in Maine gets something out of it that's distinct from what the Post brings to an equation like that?
Well, what we hope is that whatever – if we're writing about a candidate in Maine, that we're really telling something about the story of the election, the candidate or the race has an echo that will resonate in other places. That there's a storyline behind our illustrations, a larger story. And that's what we're really trying to do, stories that sure, I hope people in Maine will read it, but also that it will resonate all over the country and maybe in places that are concerned and interested in American politics. And that's a lot of places around the world.
There are many, many different forms of journalism that exist today that weren't even dreamed of when you were getting your start at the Milwaukee Journal. There are bloggers, social media journalists, multimedia journalists, general assignment reporters, the entire spectrum. As you visit with journalism students in Milwaukee, what do you see as the right training ground for journalists today?
Well, it's wide open. I mean, it's a great time. The first thing I say, particularly to the young people, that it's a great profession to enter. And I want it to be a magnet profession again like it was when I went to school in the post-Watergate era when everyone wanted to be like Woodward and Bernstein. There was a glamour to investigative reporting. But now the digital age is just continues to create jobs. The median age at the Washington Post is younger than it's ever been. And that'll continue to be the case because we have young people with different skill sets. They've grown up in a period where things that are digital are natural to them. That is part of their natural DNA. And we're all trying to create more digital DNA in our newsrooms, people who have the instinct to have different – try out different storytelling forms, interactive graphics, embedded developers. That's a job. People who know audience, and we have audience engagement teams. We have a range of different kind of work that we're doing that opens up a newsroom. And so you still need to have the fundamentals, the judgment. You need to know about values and ethics and all of the things that we always needed to know. But there's just a range of different skills that a lot of people are bringing in to our profession now, and we welcome.
We hear a lot about the relatively low esteem in which many people view journalists. What has to happen to return journalism to this kind of, if not exalted, certainly a profession that's looked up to?
Well, I think they have a greater distrust of politicians that we cover. But, you know, I think you know, I don't know about the esteem. I know that people have feelings about how we do our jobs and thinks we're sometimes intrusive. But, you know, whenever there's a big story where they're going to tune in, when the Malaysian airplane goes down, they want to know what's going on. They tune into us. When any kind of tragedy, when anything happens around the world, typhoons, mudslides, the need to know brings people to journalism. And so I think that we have a place in society. You know, it's not necessarily to be loved, but it is to be to help to educate and chronicle and enlighten. And I think we do a good job overall. The business has changed, and you know, I'm not one of the people who want to weed people out of the craft and say, you know, you're not a journalist, you're not a journalist, you're not a journalist. You know, the definition of what a journalist is expanding, and if people want to call themselves journalists, they can. I know at the Washington Post we do a kind of journalism that I think that people have come to us for 8 decades, and I think they'll continue to come to us.
Is there something that newspapers ought to be doing to better reach out to the next generation of would-be readers?
Well, I think to try to write about and produce journalism that people want to share. I mean, I think part of the culture here is that a lot of – you know, I have young people. I have 2 sons. You know, one's 31, one's 28, and another is 18. And so they're part of this millennial culture. And, you know, they're going to different sites. They're not going to just the Washington Post. That's not their homepage. They're basically – drawn by work that moves them, engages them. So that is everything as small as writing better headlines. That's everything from creating, trying different forms, more explainers, more video, more graphics, more Q&As. And it's also trying to understand the generation that is coming up now. I mean, reporting on them and in a way that feels sophisticated and engaging. And so I think we've always, you know, had, you know, I don't think we started out saying, well, our business is just for older people, senior citizens, our moms. But trying to reach people is about both subject, but it's also about form. And I think that's what the lessons of this time teaches.
Well, Kevin Merida, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Best of luck.
Thank you, Mitch.
Kevin Merida is managing editor at The Washington Post, in charge of news and feature coverage. His professional journalism career started at the Milwaukee Journal in the late 70s. He was back in Milwaukee recently to keynote an event held by the Public Policy Forum and by Marquette University. A major grant goes to studying the science of virtue. We'll learn what the science of virtue actually is when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. A major grant was announced this spring for a project to study the science of virtue. The Templeton Religion Trust has awarded $2.6 million to the work being co-directed by Marquette University philosophy professor Nancy Snow. It's the largest grant to support a program in the humanities in the university's history. The project will play out over 3 years and will include researchers from a variety of disciplines, ranging from philosophy to theology to the natural sciences. To learn more about how science might quantify something as basic as virtue, Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke was joined in the studio by Nancy Snow in April. She explained what the pressing questions about virtue are that she seeks to answer.
Our work is multidisciplinary, and I'm co-directing the grant with a developmental psychologist from Notre Dame, Darsha Narvaez. And we think that we need to get clearer about what virtue is. So most people have an intuitive sense about what virtue is, but philosophers have disagreed. And so, for example, Aristotle thinks that virtue is an entrenched state of character, and it's dispositional. And it produces virtuous actions that are appropriately motivated and guided by practical reason. Hume thinks that virtues are traits that are useful or agreeable to ourselves and others. Aristotle, of course, is an ancient Greek philosopher. David Hume, people might not know about that much, and he was writing around the time of the 1700s in Scotland. And, you know, we have to figure out what it is that we're looking at. What are we trying to measure? But we're also trying to figure out how the self, that is, how what it means to be a person, is implicated in the development of virtue. So we need to figure out exactly how it is that virtue takes root in people and grows and develops and can be nurtured.
And when you talk about the notion of the self, this is more than just someone's personality.
Yes, yes. You might think of the self as something that sort of underlies both personality and character. And Darsha and I have a disagreement about this. I mean, Darsha thinks that personality and character are pretty much the same thing. I tend to disagree. But to your question, the self is the person who endures throughout life. So we can think a little bit about baby Mitch, right, or baby Nancy. And we can think of ourselves growing up through childhood and adolescence and then, you know, middle age and then as we grow old. And we think of ourselves as basically the same person, having the same self. Now, we might go through some personality changes and some character changes, and we hope we do. We hope we grow into good people. But, you know, those changes in our personality or character are sort of flexible. So we can think about people who are really robust and lively in middle age, and then as they grow older and they lose their physical or mental capacities, perhaps they become more withdrawn or even embittered. So that self endures even though the character or the personality changes.
Are there absolutes in the study of virtue? Are there things that are generally agreed on as attributes that feed into this?
Well, generally people think that things like courage, generosity, I was going to say humility, but there's a little bit of doubt about humility in some quarters. But certainly courage, generosity, kindness, compassion, those kinds of traits are generally regarded as virtues. I wouldn't call them absolutes. I would be hesitant to say that at this stage of the research, anything could be regarded as an absolute. And that's because we are very interested in finding empirical support for what we're doing.
It's easy to envision how this work could play out in the philosophy, theology arenas, maybe even sociology. But how do the natural sciences approach virtue?
Well, that's a really good question. And the good answer that I can give you is that there is a fair amount of neuroscientific work going on right now about the neurophysiological substrates or structures that might support virtue. And so neuroscientists do weigh in on the conception of the self. They weigh in on our cognitive and emotional capacities, which go into virtue. So they are certainly in the game here.
Are we at the point where you could put somebody into a functional MRI machine and see which parts of the brain are lighting up when virtuous acts are going on?
We can definitely see which parts of the brain are lighting up when people think about virtuous acts. And there is a neuroscientist named George Moll from Brazil, who has put people into fMRIs in parallel sessions, and they play certain kinds of games, certain kinds of prisoner's dilemma type games, for example. And as they are asked to conceptualize certain scenarios, he measures what areas of the brain light up. So he has some results about trust, for example, and honesty, and that's fascinating work.
I imagine people are going to see this news and they might say $2.6 million to study virtue. What in the world is this going to do?
Well, we hope it'll do a lot of things. And it is sponsored by the Templeton Religion Trust. And we hope that, well, in the short term, for example, what it's going to do is to seed 10 new research projects that are going to be collaborations between scientists and humanists. And they'll do empirically grounded work on virtue and the self and moral development. And we'll have three conferences in which we discuss this work. Now, in the long term, what we hope is that we can get clearer on what character is, on what specific virtues are, and on how they develop in children and in young people, and that downstream from this research, we'll be able to implement those insights into educational programs. My co-director, Darsha Narvaez, has implemented her views on moral education in the Minnesota public schools. And this is something that we intend will make a difference down the road in terms of how we educate people.
We hear a lot about the idea of character education, but I wonder, as you're involved in this kind of study, whether the character education we think of today is still at a very basic level, whether this has the potential to really shape what character education looks like in the years to come.
I think it does. We are, as you suggest, in very early stages of finding out what character is and of subsidizing character education. And everything that we can do to get clearer on that helps to address a rather urgent question, and that is, how can we raise good people? How can we raise good children? How can we address the culture of bullying that seems to be in our society? And we hope this research will make a difference toward that. And, you know, I am very optimistic. I don't want to sound arrogant, but I do think that this has the potential for being a game changer in the years to come.
Where did your own journey in this field begin?
Well, I've been interested in virtues for a long time, and some of my earlier publications were on specific virtues like compassion and humility. And then my own journey sort of began with an interest in hope. And I was fortunate to be sponsored by the John Templeton Foundation in a personal research grant to write a book on hope, which I'm still finishing. I'm doing some rewriting on it now. So these projects take a long time. But also, I mean, I got interested in the empirical aspect of virtue through a debate that was going on in philosophy. And this debate was called the Situationist Debate. So there were a number of philosophers who used social psychological studies to argue that there are essentially no such things as virtues. And I thought that couldn't be right. And so what I did was spent a few years reading the psychology, and I think they looked in the wrong places. And that so I wrote a book that was called Virtuous Social Intelligence, an Empirically Grounded Theory, that was well received both in philosophy and psychology. And I was very fortunate to be able to partner with Darsha Narvaez, and I've also partnered with several other psychologists to continue working on these aspects of virtue.
And there is going to be a book that comes out of this grant as well, correct?
There are going to be three books that come out of the grant. One is going to be a co-authored manuscript that Darsha and I write together. Another is going to be a collection of essays that will come out of the work of funded researchers. And a third is a collection of essays that are going to come out of what we put together, which is called a Moral Self Research Group. And this research group is going to be interdisciplinary, and there will be a digital research archive to house their work at the Rainer Memorial Libraries at Marquette.
Well, it sounds like you have a busy few years ahead of you. I'll let you get to it. Nancy Snow, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you.
Nancy Snow is a professor of philosophy at Marquette University. She's co-director of a research initiative called The Self, Motivation, and Virtue, which received a $2.6 million grant from the Templeton Religion Trust this spring. It's the largest humanities grant in Marquette's history. Snow spoke with Mitch Tyke in April. Coming up next, we'll learn about the heyday of pro wrestling in Milwaukee, at least from the perspective of one former villain. More of Lake Effect right after this on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Until extreme sports such as mixed martial arts supplanted it, professional wrestling was one of the most popular spectator and televised sports in the country. While some sports fans might quibble with that distinction, saying the scripted matches required no skill, but our next guest would disagree. Milwaukee native Chris Multerer, known as Chris Curtis in wrestling, spent more than 25 years in the ring, competing largely in the Midwest against some well-known opponents, including national names like Hulk Hogan and Jesse Ventura. He's been retired for a decade, but he recently wrote a book about his time in wrestling. Job Man, My 25 Years in Professional Wrestling was co-written by local author Larry Wyden. Multerer first spoke with me in March, and he started off by explaining what the term job man means.
That's a wrestling term that's used throughout the business. And so that's what we did. We went out, we did a job for a guy and put him over, made him look good. And you don't make yourself look good, you make him look good. Although in the process of doing all that, we make ourselves look like we're professionals too.
Well, but you were a professional.
Correct, yes. And we're out there to make wrestling look believable, even though it's not. And so when I was in the ring, I made sure that when I was doing my job, making the star look good, I made sure everything was crisp. It was tight and...
And that the audience bought it.
Right. That's the biggest thing. You have to make sure that the audience bought it, because if something was off a little bit, and it happens, they catch on real quick. And so you have to sometimes ad lib and, you know, it's you're on the spot. There's no do-overs out there. So, yeah.
Well, talk a little bit about that kind of agreement that the audience has with professional wrestling. I mean, people know... On some level, I think that it's, I don't want to say not real, because you're actually out there doing things and right. You're making it work, but you're not fighting to the death, literally.
Correct. We're out there basically working a play. That's what we're doing. There's two athletes that are working a play, and there's a start of the play, there's the middle of the play, and then there's the finish, the ending of the play. But while we're out there, you have to make sure... You keep those people guessing, even though there's people out there that say, well, no, this is not on the up and up. It's not on the level. You still keep them guessing. And that's why you go all out, but you're not out there to hurt your opponent.
So, right. What I like about it is that it's very much theater.
Correct. And if we were actually out there trying to hurt each other, there would be no professional wrestling. The business would be dead. It would be gone because there would be nobody left. What we do is we work a match and it goes on to the next week and the next week and the next week, and you keep building on that every single week, day, month.
So the story gets added to?
The story gets added to it, and there's just so many different levels that you can carry it on to. It's kind of like a flower. It blooms and it gets bigger and bigger, and you know, finally the flower can't go anymore, so you start with something new, and just before that ends. So
one of the things that you also do in pro wrestling is you have characters that are in this play. So talk about your character, Chris Curtis.
My main thing, I was the heel. I was the villain. It came natural to me because when I was a kid, for whatever reason, I was always obnoxious and getting into trouble. Not serious trouble, but just obnoxious trouble. And I would go out in the ring and bait the crowd, do whatever I could to get them riled up. And while I was working the baby face, the good guy, a heel is out there to make the baby face look strong. We're basically... the weaker, and so that's why we resort to cheating and underhanded tactics, because we can't legitimately overtake them. So many times, too, the good guy, the baby face, would be the very muscular, stronger, better looking, that type of thing, the more athletic, where a heel was not as built as they were, but we still are very good athletes. Our job was to get the ire of the crowd.
Well, I've looked at some of the pictures in the book, and I have to say, you know, in your younger days, you could have certainly been a baby face if you'd wanted to. You look sort of angelic with your curly hair. You know, you had just like these nice expressions and everything. Mm-hmm. So did you use that to make people think you were something different than the heel that you were in this character?
You know, I never really thought about that. I just went out there and I was just being me. And I never over-exaggerated because people can sense that. That's the way the business is nowadays. You get a lot of guys, they over-exaggerate their mannerisms. I never did that. I just went out there and did what I had to do. And you just, you know, I could just look at somebody and really tick them off. So it was a thing where I guess I just used my natural good looks to tick off people.
And you also, one of the things that was just, I have to say, I sort of shuddered as I was reading the book, was the list of injuries that you sustained doing all of this, doing your job as the job man and making these guys look good. My goodness, rotator cuff, knees, concussion, what else?
I broke my hand. I tore my rotator cuff wrestling Victor the Bear. That was before I got into wrestling. I would have to tape my knees up. I probably dislocated my kneecaps completely at least a dozen times. I bruised my kidneys, had a couple concussions, split my head open probably a dozen times, that kind of stuff.
And is that typical for anyone who's in this business?
More often than not, it's usually knee injuries or hip injuries. A lot of the old timers now, they've had hip replacements, knee replacements. They've had their discs in their back fused. A lot of them are in wheelchairs, walkers. I'm lucky I didn't end up like that. But those guys also wrestled 7,000 to 10,000 matches throughout their career, and they were in the business 35 to 40 years. So they did it full time. I did it part time. So 700 matches to 800 matches is still a lot. But I'm still pretty healthy. My knees are bad. They're getting a little worse now. So, but you had to go out there. You had no choice. If you didn't work, you didn't get paid. So if you hurt, you had to deal with it.
How did you train and learn how to do the falls and how to do the kinds of things you did in the ring to not really hurt each other, but to make it look like you were?
I actually went to a training camp for about 3 months down in a – used to be a little pool room on second off of National. Guy had a ring set up. And we learned how to work holds. We learned how to fall correctly without hurting ourselves. We learned how to flip, learn how to go over the top rope, that kind of thing. The most important part about falling is tucking your head, protecting the back of your head. And so you do this continually 5 days a week over a three-month period, and that's what I did. Then you learn how to work a match and so forth. It's all on-the-job training. But yeah, it takes a long time to make sure that you know how to fall, because you land the wrong way, especially on your neck or the back of your head, and you could be crippled for life.
Yeah, or die.
It's happened.
Yeah.
So.
Now, when you talk about, you know, working a match, in the book you talked about meeting up with the superstars that you were jobbing for and talking about what you were going to do. Was that always the case? You talk ahead of time and like, okay, this is the story and this is how we're going to do it. You knew the moves and that sort of thing?
Yeah. A good example would be like Greg Gagne. I wrestled Greg in the AWA probably a couple dozen times. Basically what you would do, and I'm using him as an example, you meet up beforehand. They tell you how many minutes you're going to go. You might go 10 to 12 minutes. You work out possibly a beginning, what you're going to do, a couple of high spots. And a high spot, Bonnie, is when you see the guys hit the ropes back and forth, that's called a high spot. And then you always come up with a finish. You don't want to go over too much because the crowd might not be buying what you're doing. So the heel, which would be me, we would always, you know, if I had to improvise, I would do that. The heel always called the match in the ring. So if you have the guy in a headlock, basically you're almost a ventriloquist because you talk to the guy and you try not to move your lips. And so you basically go over everything and you see how the crowd reacts. But yeah, you always come up with a little something beforehand. Sometimes there were situations where if you were in a certain town, and you had a baby face dressing room and a heel dressing room that was completely on the opposite side of the auditorium or whatever the case may be, you called everything in the ring. And so that was it. The finish, what would happen would be usually the referee would give you the finish when you get in the ring while you're waiting for the other guy, because the booker of the territory would give the referee the finish, and then from there you would just work something out in there.
To get to that finish.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and then we would call it. So it's not as easy as it looks. You got to make sure that it comes off right. Otherwise, if it falls apart, it's not a good situation.
Well, not only do you have to, you know, make a scenario that works for the two of you, but you got to get the crowd believing you too.
Correct. And there's certain things that you also do. You have different matches in the card. You have the opener and you have an added attraction and a special attraction and a semifinal and a main event. You're not going to give everybody everything in an opening match. I worked a lot of opening matches, and I loved it because it's my job, it's our job to get the crowd warmed up. So you're going to give them a few things, and then the next match will give them a little bit more, and then the match after that's going to give them more, and then the main event gives them pretty much everything. So it's all a matter of what they're going to buy.
But that's your skill. I mean, you have to be able to turn on a dime.
Exactly. And that's the thing. You cannot be afraid of the audience. You have to be in control of the crowd. If you're not in control of the crowd, you're going to freeze up and it's going to be a disaster. Being a heel, we have a different personality than the good guy, the baby face. We have to go in there with that devil-may-care personality that I'm in charge, you're not, and that's that. And you're going to buy what we're doing, and if they don't like it, I'm going to get on the audience, and they might start responding, but we're the ones who control everything.
Villains are always more fun to play.
Oh, yeah. I was a natural. I mean, I've worked as a babyface before. It's okay, but that's not me. I'm the antagonist. That's what I like the best. So when I have a 85-year-old lady with thick glasses flipping me off and telling me how much she hates me, and you know that
you've won.
Exactly.
Yeah, you made it. Mm-hmm. Now that you are retired from this.
Yes, for 10 years.
How do you stay in touch with it? Do you?
No. I don't watch it anymore. The business has changed so much from what it used to be. I want nothing to do with what's going on out there today. It's too soap opera-like. It's not even wrestling anymore. It's more glorified bodybuilders, combination, gymnasts. I mean, they're great athletes, don't get me wrong, but it's not wrestling. It's not like it used to be. I'm kind of like a history guy, like the old days, the way when I was in it and when the way I grew up. That's, to me, was real wrestling. And even the old timers, the old legends would say the same thing. They really want nothing to do with it.
Leave us with a favorite remembrance, a favorite story of a person or a match that you had.
One of the matches that I did have, I was down in Shreveport, Louisiana, and I was working for Cowboy Bill Watts. We were doing a tag team match. It was myself and a wrestler named Ben Alexander, and we were wrestling Ernie Ladd and Mike George. Ernie Ladd used to play pro football, and I was standing in the corner of the ring, and you had very little room to stand because the ropes were so close to the edge, so you had to be careful. I was the baby face, and Ben Alexander was in trouble, so he tagged off to me. Well, I went to come in, and I misstepped on the edge of the ring, and I landed on the floor, and I'm laying on the floor, and Bill Watts is doing the commentary, and he goes, "What happened to Curtis?" He said he's ready to make his comeback, and he's nowhere to be found, and here I am laying on the floor, half dazed. So I had to climb back into the ring, and you know, then he just finished me off. But it was pretty funny just the way it was, because everybody was looking around for me and they couldn't find me anywhere. There I am crawling back in the ring. So
it's like, what happened?
Exactly.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for coming in and sharing a little bit of your very colorful past with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Chris Molterer, known to wrestling fans as Chris Curtis, is the author of Job Man, My 25 Years in Professional Wrestling. It was co-written by local author Larry Wyden. We first spoke with Molterer in March. We'll take one last break, and then we'll speak with a writer and former Milwaukee news reporter about his collection of essays. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect returns now. I'm Bonnie North. Writer Scott Jacobs may have left Wisconsin for the sunny climes of, well, Illinois, but his home state is never far from his mind. Case in point, Jacobs' new book. It's a collection of essays called Famous Ski Hills in Wisconsin and Other Delusions of Grandeur. Much of the tongue-in-cheek memoir mines his long connections with Wisconsin. Jacobs talked with me in March about how the state's distinctive skiing tradition informed the title essay and the collection in general.
Well, everybody has one favorite ski hill, and that's the one where you learn to ski. My famous ski hill was a little ski hill called Little Switzerland in Slinger, Wisconsin. I would go there all the time as a kid. I still remember kind of getting put at the top of the hill and pushed off. And, you know, you go a ways and you fall down and somebody comes and picks you up. And then you usually wind up getting to the bottom between the legs of your dad. But when you get to the bottom, you look back and say, hey, that wasn't so bad. I did that. And it's only like years later you realize the ski hill was only 200 feet high. And it was a great experience. And that's what kind of got me started. I start that chapter by saying, you know, winter's a time to mine the memories, you know, mine our memory. And that's where I start.
You grew up here, right? You grew up...
I did. I grew up in Waukesha County. I did a lot of things. I played golf on the public links of Milwaukee. I would go skiing. I'd go out to the Dells. I enjoyed growing up in Wisconsin. I actually came back when I was 21 out of college, and my first job was as a reporter for the Milwaukee Sentinel. So I've kind of had it as a kid, and I've had it as a young man.
And you talk about that. I mean, this is a collection of short essays that sort of goes in a lot of different directions. It's fun. What I like about it is that it's not a memoir in the traditional chronological sense. You kind of go in a lot of different places. And one essay, we're at the Dells. And then the other essay, you know, we're at Slinger at the Hill. And maybe we're over somewhere else thinking about something else. And it's really a lot of fun to kind of get your impressions of what Wisconsin was like and in comparison what it's like now.
I think my theme here is Wisconsin isn't a state, it's a state of mind. You grow up and you're taught to be adventuresome. And on the Sentinel, I was taught to be curious. You put the two of them together and you can find interest in my case, in ordinary life. But I think and hope that other people like read my childhood memories and it'll spur their own childhood memories, because a lot of childhood is the same. And I have to say, it's a rural experience. You know, I don't speak to what it is to grow up in the inner city of Milwaukee. That's just not my experience, but I recognize that that's its own experience.
You started out your first job as a reporter. That's a very specific kind of writing. When you started to do this, to write these essays, I don't even know, it's kind of hard. We were talking before we turned on the mics about how trying to describe exactly what it is. They're essays, but they're also memoir. Was that a shift for you in terms of actual writing and in approaching how you were going to tell these particular stories?
You know, I have an online magazine that I've published for 20 years, almost since the first days of the World Wide Web. And I write a lot of politics in it, and I write a lot about, I've written about my neighborhood in Chicago. It's called The Week Behind. And if you write a story every week for 20 years, you kind of have holes. So these are some of the stories I wrote in between, just things that caught my attention. And then you start like a reporter tracking them, following along the thought and saying, where's that going to take me? And so there is no specific theme that I put together for this. They're just stories that I liked writing, and I hope people have fun reading.
So for you as a writer, it's all writing. It doesn't matter whether you're writing for the magazine, you're writing something about politics, or you're writing one of these. You're approaching it in the same way, it sounds like.
I think writing's a discipline, and I think you have to discipline yourself to do it. So this was part of my discipline, was to write a story every week. And when the easiest thing for me is to write about myself and my memories. Memories, you know, you can have just sitting at a typewriter or a computer in this case. So I don't know that there's any particular discipline. I make documentaries, so I'm aware of doing things in a visual context. But these were intended to be written stories.
But you mentioned the visual, and a lot of the stories that you tell have a very visual component. In other words, you're painting a really clear picture about something. Even if I didn't have that experience, like that hill, you know, skiing down mm-hmm. that hill, I found myself, you know, feeling like I was there. You're able to bring that to life in a way. And so I have a feeling that your documentary work is also.
I think you have to think and write cinematically. There are many good books in which you can get into someone's head and they will let you rattle around there forever. I kind of like action. I like to have things happen. I like to see what's happening, and I think cinematically. I want to describe what's going on around me.
As you were writing these stories and then putting them together in the book, was anything a surprise that you remembered or that you thought, gosh, I haven't thought of that in years, or something that made you step back a little bit as the writer?
I think I'm surprised as a writer always by what comes in the next paragraph. It's a process, and it's a discovery that you go through. I mean, I started writing about my cousin Bones and I going sledding, and I was amazed at how much I remembered about the experience of sledding, right down to Mr. Johnson's hardware store and all the sleds that were arrayed in the front window. These are not things that I carry around with me necessarily, but as you start writing about things, ideas come to you, and you put one after the next, and before you know it, it's a story.
Have you found that as people have read the book and commented to you about it, that it does what you hope it does, that they start thinking about their own memories?
Yes. The best part about it is getting a letter from somebody saying, oh, you know, I went to City College and here was our college cheer. Someone else says, it just brought back fond memories of when I was on Wilmot Hill, or everybody has their favorite ski hill.
Wherever you're from. Do you find that when you do readings here in Wisconsin that you get particular excitement from the audience, particularly of people your age?
I hope so. I'm just starting to do readings this week. So, yes, I hope people, you know, hear it, laugh and enjoy it and go back and either read the book again or write their own stories. I mean, part of what is very important to me is that people see their lives as stories, and if you want to write, write it down.
I know the book is just out. Are you planning to do more, or is there other projects that you have in mind now that the book is complete?
I don't have anything specific. One of the things that I did a little bit in this book, there's a chapter that in the e-book has video incorporated into the story. I think that's a very interesting direction to be going. Because I write on the internet, I'm comfortable putting videos in mixed with words and audio tracks and other things like that. I think if I do another book, I'm going to look for instances where I can blend those things and do it as a digital version.
The essay you're talking about is about making the father-son video, taking video of your son learning to fish, right?
Yes, this is it's called Movie Magic, and it came about because I went up to the cottage, as we do, and I took my little video camera and I made a little video of my son learning to fish, and I came back and found a 16mm film my father had shot 50 years ago at the same cottage on the same dock with me fishing, and it was a home movie just like mine. So I looked for other instances, and there's a, you know, I went to a little 4th of July parade, and I took my movie and found that my dad had made the exact same movie 50 years before at a different Memorial Day parade. And, you know, it got me thinking about home movies. We all shoot them, and, you know, we're not really trying to tell a story. We just shoot until the film runs out or the battery goes dead. And then we put them in a closet and never edit them. And, you know, all of a sudden there's no more VHS or there's no more SD cards now. So much of that gets lost. But what's not lost in my mind looking at all of it together is the continuity, the fact that 50 years apart, we made the same movie.
It's great to be able to incorporate that. And with the idea that the publishing industry is going ever more digital, you know, we're able to do those kinds of things.
I think we all have to start thinking that way. We have to think about other ways besides typing to tell stories. And I think that's happening in the schools. You know, kids are picking up camcorders, taking multimedia courses, doing animations, and that's all very cool. There's a lot of new storytelling techniques that are out there, and down the road, that's what I want to explore.
But it's still all about telling that story.
It's all about the story. It's always about the story.
Well, Scott Jacobs, I want to thank you so much for sharing some of your stories with us, and best of luck with all the readings around the state.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Writer and Waukesha County native Scott Jacobs' new collection of essays is called Famous Ski Hills in Wisconsin and Other Delusions of Grandeur. We first spoke with him in March. It's time now for our weekly segment, The Islands of Milwaukee.
Welcome to the Islands of Milwaukee.
This is Maureen Towie from the Islands of Milwaukee. This week, at one of our senior meal sites, we went to a birthday party for Marie. She was turning 100 years old. As we were chatting with other diners at Marie's table, we realized that she wasn't even the oldest person in the room. Gertie, a sweet, friendly former dancer, is 104. I asked her what 104 felt like.
Yeah, I feel the same. I don't feel any different.
No, yeah.
But I am older in my aches and pains.
Sure, sure.
I got a lot of pain. And you get one all the time is pains.
Yeah.
I got no teeth. I can't hear. I can't do nothing. I can't hardly walk. But I'm still coming. I don't give up.
Yeah.
And I keep going.
Yeah.
I'm a strong woman, they were telling me.
It just happens that our question this week is, what does courage mean to you? Right now, for me, courage looks a lot like Gertie. Thanks for listening.
You can participate in the Islands of Milwaukee project by calling the Islands Hotline. It's at 414-678-1653. You can also visit islandsofmilwaukee.org. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. You're listening to us on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.